there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 332. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a great episode for you this week. I have to pause right here and say, and I feel like I always need to do this more and more, perhaps every week, and just say, this is such an incredible opportunity for me to do this show over the past 7+ years and get to talk to these amazing folks. And then I get to have guests on that my parents get excited about, and I'm guaranteeing right now this week's guest is one of those guests. Let me introduce her to you. Eve Sicular is a drummer, a band leader, a film scholar, and so much more. Eve formed and leads the New York City-based bands Isle of Klesbos, which is an all-women sextet. They formed in 1998 and have arguably the best name of any group ever created ever. Just want to put that out there. And she formed the Metropolitan Klezmer Octet, and they've been around since 1994. Eve has produced both of the band's acclaimed CDs, as well as their band tours throughout North America and Europe. Eve's musical and multimedia archival projects have received accolades from just about everywhere, including the Sparkplug Foundation, Out Music Awards, Chamber Music America, New York State Council on the Arts, and New York City's Department of Cultural Affairs. Eve's arrangements have been heard on Showtime's The L Word, HBO's Schmata, Rags to Riches to Rags, CBS Sunday Morning, as well as pieces at the New York Theater Workshop, the Museum of the City of New York, the Wexner Center, the Jewish Museum, and the Contemporary Jewish Museum. Her original musical documentary theater piece, J. Edgar Klezmer, Songs from My Grandmother's FBI Files, for which Eve wrote the lyrics, that premiered in 2009 at the Dixon Place in New York City with a full staging in 2010 at the JCC in Manhattan. Eve has published and lectured internationally on topics such as the celluloid closet of Yiddish films and music in Yiddish cinema, and Eve is a former curator of the film and photo archives at the YIVO Institute. Right this second, though, Eve is here with us on This Show Is So Gay. Eve, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Holy cow, Eve. That about runs out the time that we have for this week's episode. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much there, Ken.
So much to discuss. Are you ready?
I am.
Now, is there one particular title that you gravitate towards? Drummer, band leader, film scholar, musician? Is there something that is quintessential Eve?
Wow, it is dependent on you know, what's going on that particular week or show or whatever. But yeah, I would say drummer, band leader does a lot of it. You know, it's nice for me because some of the more recent projects that you mentioned, you know, we even have some updates beyond what is on our website, because I'm, you know, like so many creative people, always trying to catch up with the writing synopsis of everything. But this piece that I'm the composer, lyricist, and grandchild for, J. Edgar Klezmer, Songs from My Grandmother's FBI Files. We've had a very exciting year with that, and we are going to be presenting a sort of one-night-only show a little bit outside New York at a place called the Emeline Theater very, very soon after you air this show. That'll be Saturday night, December the 5th.
Nice.
In Mamaroneck, New York, which is a little bit north of Manhattan. And we had an off-Broadway run of it in June, which actually got a nice New York Times review, I must say. And we were able to stage it at a place called Centenary Stage Company even before that. So 2015 has been a really big year for J. Edgar Klezmer to kind of get out there in its fully fledged form. And 2014 was a big, big year because not only did we have our new Isle of Klezmer CD live from Brooklyn, which I know we'll have time to play music from that, and we also had our Metropolitan Klezmer 20th anniversary album come out right at the end of 2014. So it would still be the 20th anniversary, you know. It was a big, big doubleheader year for putting out our 6th and 7th CDs respectively. So in that producer hat was was very big on recordings last year, and this year I actually I'm very proud of myself because I also finally memorized all my lines in J. Edgar Klesmer. It was no longer a reading, but it was a real play. So I'm psyched about that.
Well, let's go basic. Let's go with the basics. Why the medium of music to get your voice out there? What does music do for Eve?
Yeah, it's not one of those things that I feel like was really so much of a choice. It just is really. My background with music is that unlike a lot of my bandmates, many of whom are like really conservatory trained, like amazingly versatile and really fun musicians, but definitely, you know, serious Juilliard and Manhattan School of Music,
sure,
and Eastman, you know, and all that. But I'm more self-taught, but I fortunately came from, on my father's side, very, very seriously steeped classical pianists. And so my ear was developed really well. I'm really naturally a drummer, and I'm very lucky that at age 8, I was at a summer day camp where they were offering either ukulele, which was so not me, like, you know, the small version of guitar for little kids' hands, or fortunately the drums. And there was even a woman music camp counselor with her daughter in the class, so I wasn't the only girl. Because it wasn't always that easy back when I was coming up to be a, you know, a girl playing drums wasn't always encouraged. But, you know, fortunately, as I said, I got a really good early start at it. And so the band leader thing is partly because, you know, what I do is really not something you can do so much as a soloist. And I did have a lot of ideas about repertoire and arrangements. So it was really great to be able to, especially with klezmer music, you know, really find these wonderful people who I've been working with for, you know, good long stretches of time and a really collaborative spirit. So, you know, often one person will be a composer, but in other situations, you know, I'll find something that I'm really just inspired to adapt, you know, from either some folkloric source, or a lot of times, you know, popular culture that's been kind of overlooked, like vintage archival things, you know, that just have a great song in the background,
right,
you know, an old Yiddish film or even a sitcom or a Soviet cartoon, you know, from the 60s or whatever. You know, so I've just been a gleaner in many situations. I've been a curator and an archivist, actually. I did work at a wonderful Yiddish archive as the photo and film archivist because I also had a background. I have a fancy schmancy BA title. I never went past, you know, just regular old four-year college, but I was at a nice Ivy League school where I studied Russian history and literature, and fortunately they had a copy of the autobiography of a Soviet woman filmmaker, sort of a pioneer editor, who developed her own style of making films just by creating documentaries from pre-existing footage. And her name was Esther Shub. So that really opened up like a whole lot of great things for me and led me eventually to the Yiddish Celluloid Closet project. I was a really enamored fan of the late, great Vito Russo. In 1989, when I was still living in Seattle, and when Vito had already, you know, been a founder of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, I did write my first grant proposal, and we brought him out there to give a Clips lecture.
Wow.
Of the Celluloid Closet. And then the following year, I actually moved back to New York, but very sadly, that was also the year that Vito died of AIDS. And so as fate would have it, the following year after that, 1991, I was working as like the assistant to the curators of a really big Yiddish film festival that was taking place at the Museum of Modern Art. It was co-produced by the National Center for Jewish Film. And I got the gig because of my Esther Shub research back from college days, long story, but I'll just say that, you know, somebody wisely said, oh, you're doing klezmer music and you know Yiddish, maybe you could work with these curators who need somebody who has, you know, these different language skills. So there I was doing program notes and running around and whatever errands I needed, and started to notice in various films, you know, at various moments, that there were things a lot like Vito Russo had pointed out in Hollywood films or in European classic films, you know, that were maybe Once there was a code and you weren't allowed to mention certain things directly about homosexuality, but there would be all these hints and double entendres and things like that. So I just, you know, almost couldn't believe I was seeing these things in Yiddish film. And a couple of years went by, and I kept meaning to write kind of a paper, an article, and finally the opportunity presented itself. So as with a lot of things in my life, I discovered that if I do have, like, a deadline or an assignment, you know, to really put something together, it's like a godsend, you know.
Yeah.
So that really got me to write the paper, which eventually got me to lecture at some really nice queer film festivals, and then later on Jewish film festivals and, you know, community centers, all kinds of places. So now it's over 20 years that I've been, you know, going to colleges and great, you know, film conference settings and all kinds of places to be able to give a clips lecture myself, which is something that I was really inspired to do watching Vito. He was such a generous and hilarious and politically intense but just wonderfully warm person. And, you know, he went so young, and
yeah,
yet, you know, so many people remember him
such an
beautifully
impact.
And his style of lecturing was just, you know, inimitable, but still very inspiring to what I do.
So incredible. Talk to me about Yiddish. How are we doing with the preservation of Yiddish? You know, I think my mom is doing her part, and certainly I hear more than enough of it, but, you know, so much less so than my grandmother. And I don't think that as a college professor, I'm going to really count those two examples as significant research, but it leads me to think, oh gosh, are we doing everything that we can do to preserve this culture?
Well, you know, I feel like my world is pretty skewed in that I know a number of people who are really quite fluent and some of whom have really taught themselves. For instance, the actress Yelena Shmulenson, who's in J. Edgar Klesmer. I mean, in some ways we're fortunate because, for one thing, the wave of migration from the former Soviet Union, there are quite a number of people whose backgrounds in Slavic languages, you know, and some are Jewish and, you know, I mean, many are Jewish, but some are not, who are really intrigued with Yiddish. You can go to various European cultural capitals and find people who really are steeping themselves in this and are absolutely remarkable. And, of course, you know, among Hasidim, there's a whole high birth rate and a lot of people speaking Yiddish, but that's kind of, it's a different world, and yet, you know, it does interact, and it means there is kind of an active population there that's got a very, very lively, active Yinglish Yiddish, whatever, Yeshivish Yiddish. But, you know, in terms of playing klezmer music, it's really beautiful because I constantly am hearing stories of how very attached people are to Yiddish, and not just in a kind of schmaltzy, nostalgic way, although, you know, that can be part of things.
Sure.
But I feel really like, I mean, it helps to be in New York or in, you know, some of these Yiddish summer programs abroad or whatever, but I really do see a lot of people of all ages and generations who are very devoted to Yiddish. On the one hand, you can look at it that way, and on the other hand, you can say, well, you know, maybe a lot of this is quote-unquote post-vernacular, you know, where Yiddish can sometimes become kind of emblematic and not necessarily be something that is just really as based in a kind of vibrancy. And certainly there's a fluency in terms of people who had Yiddish in a different context that we may never have again, certainly between the Holocaust and also real pressures in this country for assimilation and, you know, Stalin after World War II really coming down hard on Yiddish culture and in the Soviet Union. I mean, there were many, many terribly decimating things
right,
that have happened. But I do feel very heartened and very encouraged all the time because I know that in terms of doing klezmer music, people are just so intrigued with it. And people never cease to want to know more. And we don't have as many people to learn from who grew up, you know, in a really fluent environment and more of a secular kind of world. But still, you know, it's definitely, even beyond what Isaac Bashevis Singer said, which I think was something like, Yiddish has been dying for 100 years, may it die for 100 more or whatever. But that was in his I think that's what he said in his Nobel Prize speech. But, you know, anyway, I feel like we could play some music and give people a taste of, yeah, of what it is beyond just the cliches.
You are certainly doing that. By the way, I feel like we have to go even more basic. Eve, what if we have listeners out there who keep hearing this word klezmer and they're thinking, is that the Indigo Girls? I don't know who that is. What kind of music is that? Tell us about klezmer music.
Well, it's funny you say that because actually if they've seen the Indigo Girls tour in the last few years, or maybe a lot of years, or heard their records, actually, their pianist accordionist is also a very serious klezmer musician.
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, it turns out the whole Indigo Girls rhythm section are like of the tribe, if you know what I'm saying.
I know. Trust me, I know what you're saying. I had no idea.
Yeah. And there's a couple of tribes here. I mean, you know, so we're the overlapping tribes. We're like tribal, like with Jill Sobule. Oh yeah, was that in the bio you read? We've been having fun with Jill Sobule and her project about songs from Yentl. You know, she has her whole own thing that has nothing to do with Barbra Streisand's adaptation, but she wrote a bunch of very cool sort of transgenderified view of the story.
I had no.
But anyway.
So for people who don't know klezmer music, how would you describe it? In fact, on behalf of the Klezmer Appreciation Society, and you're going to increase your membership right now, sell it to our listening audience.
Okay. Well, klezmer music is the celebratory music of Yiddish culture, which means coming originally from like Eastern European Jewish traditions. And it's very much of a roots music, and it's very, very highly, beautifully versatile. I mean, there is stuff in our repertoire that is so swinging and that is so transcendent and it is so rollicking and rambunctious. So there's all kinds of stuff. There's wedding dance music where, you know, people think about getting lifted up in the chairs, and that's really fun for me as a drummer, playing all these great syncopated beats and having a real wailing horn section and everything. And then there's beautifully entrancing Yiddish balladry and street singing and tango that, you know, could have traveled the world from Poland to Argentina and back again. So there's really quite a lot of influence in klezmer from some of the other musics in the world that I am most gravitating towards, Greek music, Turkish music, Arabic music, Romanian music, and in some ways, as far as, again, being from a rhythm section, you know, there are things that remind me of other music I've played, such as Cajun Zydeco, Second Line New Orleans. So there's all kinds of ways that people can swagger and get all, as we say, klezmerobic, you know, in what they're doing, but can also really go into a trance state. So it's almost as broad as a term like jazz, but the one thing I will say about klezmer, it is not Jewish jazz. And don't make me go all ethnomusicological. So sometimes people try for shorthand and it gets a little too watered down or oversimplified. Nothing that I love as much as jazz, but there are some real differences between the two.
Now, if I were to check with the other members of the Isle of Klezmos, and don't think that I won't, Eve, because I might do it, what do you think that they would say about you as a band leader? How would they describe your style?
I guess we work together, you know, I think they'd say I work pretty hard. You know, you don't keep a band together this long without really just going to bat in a lot of situations. Let's see, maybe a little obsessive with my projects, but again, that gets the job done, especially with archival stuff where you really have to do a lot of detective work sometimes. I mean, we've got a bonus track on our new CD that is not only from an episode of Gomer Pyle USMC, but I actually, you know, not only found out who the original somewhat uncredited composer was, but found his widow to get permission. You know, by the way, one thing I want to say about that is, you know, I got inspired. There's a story behind every single gig we've ever had, and there's a story behind every single song we've ever, you know, played or recorded or arranged. And I love that particular one because the Gomer Pyle episode itself was what really led me to this piece, and what led me to that episode was when Gomer Pyle, a.k.a. Jim Nabors, you know, in real life, Jim Nabors finally came out because he got married to his partner.
Yeah.
They were living in Hawaii, and they flew to Washington State because at that time, you know, that's where they could get all legally hitched. And I thought, oh, this is so cute. And this is already in the age of Facebook. I thought, oh, yeah, right. There was that, you know, me as a klezmer band leader, how can I give a special shout-out to Jim Nabors? I thought, oh, yeah. Years ago, I watched that special episode where this great star of the Yiddish stage and screen, Molly Picon, is like one of the, you know, character actor, like shining stars. And she was the guest on this one episode, and I'd watched it like ages ago when, you know, you only had archives on VHS, and I, sure enough, there it was on YouTube. And there I am watching it on YouTube. Not only do I hear a song in the background that I didn't really catch on to when I had to be watching things just, you know, like on a schedule, on a time clock in an archive that time, but I also realized there's a gay joke in here. It's so interesting that there's like a reference in this 1968 show, right, like a pre-Stonewall reference. It's a little bit of a homophobic reference, but it's kind of an in-joke. And here's Molly Picon, who in real life is this actress who does all kinds of cross-dressing. I mean, she's known for having, like, so many trouser roles in her repertoire for, like, 40 years. And here's Jim Nabors, who it's like an open secret, you know, on any set that he ever works on, and especially on his own TV show, that, you know, here he is. He's you know, a wonderful, like, talented, flaming queen playing a really sweet, mild-mannered U.S. Marine. Go figure, he was like a side character in the Andy Griffith Show, and then they gave him his own show. And so, you know, I was like, what could have been happening on the set that television, you know, filming? Like, where did we get the, where did we get, like, hello, what was going on when they, you know, when they, like, stopped the cameras rolling, when you've got this line about, you know, her sissy decorator for her apartment.
Right.
Like, really? Really? And here's Jim Nabors, like, still out there in Hawaii. So please, listeners, if anybody can just do me a favor, either introduce me or just ask somebody to ask Jim. Like, really, I'd love it. I just, subtext is so much about, you know, what I'm tracking down all these years with the Yiddish celluloid closet. So Jim Nabors, if ever you hear this, I just want to know, in the fifth year of your series, you know, and that episode, A Little Chicken Soup Couldn't Hurt, you know, episode 10 there in 1968, really? I mean, what was your scenarist thinking, and what kind of fun were you and Molly having behind the scenes? By the way, Molly, in a photo that I found when I was the archivist at EVO, for her own Lifetime Achievement Award at this Yiddish Institute, she showed up wearing a tux and looking fantastic. But not only that, because she was already famous for all this cross-dressing, but, you know, she went the extra very important millimeter and wore a pinky ring. As somebody pointed out to me, like, 2 or 3 years already into my giving the Celluloid Closet of Yiddish Film lecture, you know, a very butch audience member said, "And what's that? She's got on her finger." And I was like, oh, my God. So, you know, between Molly and Jim, I would say something was going on there. I just can't second guess it. And I feel like we're so lucky to still have Jim with us. Maybe now that he's come out, he'll be willing to disclose what he may remember from that TV set.
Eve, I do think this is going to be your dissertation. I think you're going to go back, and this is it. Some people struggle to figure out, gosh, what am I going to write about for my dissertation? You already know. This is going
to
be it.
I think I need you for my advisor. Okay?
I will support you.
Or you feel free to assign it to a grad student, because, you know, I need to clone myself to do these things. I really do.
Oh, man. There's not enough time in the day to get this stuff done. It's so fantastic. What does it mean for you to be on stage with all women?
You know, it is primarily that they're great musicians and that it just was a wonderful project for me to develop Isle of Klezmos, because, you know, these were all people who were just so great. I mean, you know, and this has evolved over the years, and it's been just like a very steady group of people, but, you know, every once in a while there would be somebody going off to do their own thing, and so, you know, then I'd be even more blessed, it would seem like, with the next, you know, the next round of things, because it would be building on what we already had and then going on to, like, yet another amazing person and tremendous talent. So, you know, at this point, it's just we're so just us doing this, but I know that it has that extra effect on audiences. And one thing that's great, actually, is if an 8-year-old boy or girl is watching us and it doesn't register because they're already used to seeing women on brass instruments and saxophone and drums and everything, if that's not something that stands out to them, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, but I would say it still does, you know, often register with people that, wow, this is tremendous, you know,
it
and
is.
Having just all women doing this. And it's also kind of great because most of us, well, actually all of us, I must say, are composers and even lyricists, some of us. And there's just only so many rooms in the day, and people are all doing different projects. So amongst us, three of us compose and arrange. Well, no, we all arrange together, but we've all composed in our lives, but three of us compose for this band. So half of us are also, you know, writing, among other things, for Isle of Lesbos and even, you know, for Metropolitan Klezmer that does overlap in some of us. But so it's just a very, very highly beautiful, fruitful, collaborative scene, I would say.
Are you aware that the Isle of Lesbos is one of the greatest band names ever created?
Oh, well, I'm just glad that one day when I had to get beyond Klesbian, that I went for the etymology.
Was that one of the things we were entertaining, was just calling the band Klesbians?
Well, you see, Klesbian was already a very done phrase.
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was the nature of the very hip and, you know, somewhat, I would say, queerly concentrated klezmer scene of that time, you know, that Klesbian had already come up so many ways, you know.
Well, what about, you know, a couple times over the past 7 years, and not nearly enough, we've talked about that intersection of faith and queerness, and certainly with religion and gayness or faith, or just that you are playing music that is certainly religious adjacent, you know, that
right.
Certainly has those connections there. So talk to me about that intersection, particularly as you mentioned earlier, some of the pockets where Yiddish is still so prominent are much more observant branches of Judaism. And then there is that part where when we talk about some more observant branches of Judaism, we start to question, okay, and how are they with sexual orientation and anything other than the norm that they put forth. So talk to me a little bit about your experiences in that intersection.
You know, I was saying before that every gig, you know, has this kind of great backstory. So,
yeah.
You know, on the one hand, we're very much involved with celebrations and life cycle events and so on, because the music is definitely very much originating from things like, you know, playing for weddings, playing for concerts that have all kinds of amazing context, but often, you know, could be associated with either a folk culture or, you know, a Jewish kind of scene, or a scene that's trying to incorporate all different faiths. And so it's an interesting thing to be playing music primarily for the love of the music and to really be, as we say, irreverently respectful.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of where we're coming from. For one thing, you know, I feel like, thank goodness, I guess I could say G-G, noticing, but thank the goddess that the Supreme Court caught up with it, because we've been playing queer weddings since just about, I think, you know, before forming this band.
Right.
And that's been great. You know, that's just been that you know, we just, as a matter of course, would get called upon to be wonderful at you know, being able to witness, you know, all these amazing people who are making such conscious choices and just being in the wonderful position of just, you know, helping them enjoy even more about, you know, declaring their love publicly. And, you know, of course, difficult situations, too. I mean, we were, you know, sometimes in the early days, you know, for instance, we were booked for somebody's ordination party from rabbinical school, and then they had to forfeit all of it, and you know, it turns out they were almost, you know, cut off from this degree that they've been, you know, working for all these years, because at that moment, their particular branch of Judaism was going to, you know, just make them choose between being out and having that. And unfortunately, a lot of those, you know, those movements within Judaism have since changed their stances. But we were witness also to some very awful things where, you know, as I said, people would be, you know, having to be closeted, and just that we were even hired to play the party was almost going to get them in so much trouble that they were going to, you know, lose their employment or lose their degree or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've seen all kinds of having the same synagogue one year say no, even in the, you know, the community hall downstairs, we can't have a woman saying, well, yeah, you know, we're just going to tacitly let that happen, to saying, yes, we now completely embrace that that's, you know, that's something that we want you to be able to do. So,
yeah.
But then, you know, you see people having their own debates. You know, sometimes we'll be performing and we'll just, you know, see people basically take up the cause for us, you know, or we'll feel sort of like, okay, you know, we're not necessarily going to go completely quietly. We're going to announce, you know, that we do have a vocalist, and that we hope that people will be able to, you know, partake of her wonderful vocal talents in another setting or whatever. And then, you know, the next time we're invited, well, lo and behold, she's also invited to sing, you know, and not because we necessarily, you know, made it a really bitter protest, but we just, you know, we want people to be aware of, you know, different choices that are available. And so, you know, it's not always that the arc of cultural progress is going in any one particular way, but I do feel like, you know, a lot of things have changed in ways that I feel are for the better.
Yeah.
Since we started off doing this, and it, you know, it does feel really great to be, you know, even if in certain situations the name Isle of Lesbos, you know, can really open a conversation, even if not everyone's going to be comfortable with it initially, at least it's coming up in a way that obviously is from a place that we have comfort with it and we can have fun with it. And you know, that on the other hand, we certainly recognize that, you know, this can be an issue for people, and we don't want to, you know, be coy about
sure.
it in that way. And, you know, not everybody in the band is Jewish. Not everybody in the band is queer. It's not the same people that are or aren't, but they are in the same proportions.
There it is. Well, I've been listening to so much of your music, and we are going to play a couple tracks from the Live from Brooklyn CD. We're going to do that part of the show, which we actually haven't done in quite some time, so we're bringing it back with you, Eve. I'm going to give you a couple of the track listings off of your Live from Brooklyn CD, and you are going to tell our listening audience, Eve, we're going to do a little self-analysis, what you think these tracks say about you, Eve. Let's see how we do. Track one, Uncle Moses' Wedding Dance. What do you think Uncle Moses' Wedding Dance says about Eve?
I love the 1932 film by that name, Uncle Moses, for so many reasons. I feel really privileged that as an archivist, I've been able to see this relatively rare movie for many years and appreciate its very authentic Yiddish, completely interspersed with all kinds of idiomatic American English expressions from 1932. It's a very early sound movie, especially for, you know, the independent ethnic cinema of Yiddish film. And this particular scene where this wedding music is heard, this tune that we transcribed and that I, you know, made into an arrangement, is so intriguing. It's beautiful in that it's got a political message. There's this marriage of a sweatshop owner who's really exploiting his workers, and you know, even the fact that this much younger woman is marrying him, she's being pressured by her parents because, you know, he's loaded, but she's really in love with the guy who's the union organizer who wants to you know, have more of a social justice around his own sweatshop. So it's just a marvelous piece of cinema, and it's a very authentic expression of the culture in New York of that time, of the early 1930s, when people were still talking about that they didn't love everything about the New World. In some ways, it was better in Europe, in the old country. And it's interesting to me because even though this is an instrumental track, the scene of many scenes in this film are so amazing, you know, in showing a kind of dystopic view of the New World, and even in ways that were not often shown in films like this again, because in international distribution, Yiddish being such an international phenomenon, especially before World War II, the fact that this was really Yinglish meant that a distributor in Warsaw or a distributor in Argentina would not be happy. He'd be getting a lot of comments from people in his audience saying they didn't understand, you know, a lot of the dialogue because it was so authentic and so New York. So there are just so many things about it. But also, we in the band personally love this because we also reference a reprise of this same melody that's just in the next scene of the film where the party's over and Uncle Moses, played by Maury Schwartz, is sitting on the edge of a bed. His bride does not look very receptive, but he is hung over and singing the same tune.
Oh,
and
man.
It's like this great, unbelievably well-inflected version of the phrasing. So it's almost like a musical, you know, the perfect musical example of how it really sounds when it's sung by a drunk person, which is actually kind of at the heart of it.
All right, I'm going to make you do one more. And I have to tell you, I've already gifted this song to my mother because I knew she was going to love it. Tell everybody, and including my mother, what you think the East Habsburg Waltz says about Eve.
Well, that says a lot about Eve's origins and both sides of her family. my mother's side, so I come from a mixed Jewish marriage, quote-unquote. My mother's side are German-speaking Czech Austrian Jews who were not the Viennese Jews who were like the refugees in World War I. They were already very established in this society. And to them, Yiddish culture was a great embarrassment. And this is really like a very, very big, long-standing divide among, you know, even among the Ashkenazic Jews, which is like just one big portion of the Jews in the world. You know, the Jews who come from Ashkenazic tradition are still very divided amongst themselves. So on my father's side, they come from Odessa. They definitely spoke a lot of Yiddish, even though I never heard them speak it ever, because that was already before my time. I really got into Yiddish just through the klezmer music and also through having studied Russian and everything. But, you know, East Habsburg, because I heard this tune, it was like, it was a gift to me. I sort of heard the first phrase, and then I just wrote this this three-part melody, and it's dedicated to my Oma, my mother's mother, because the Habsburgs were, of course, the imperial family of the Austro-Hungarian Empire that included Vienna as its capital, which is when my grandmother was born, it was still that. It was still the Habsburg Empire. And so to reference the East Habsburg, which is kind of like a fictitious and yet not fictitious place at all,
right,
it's those margins of the empire that were full of these, you know, generally less well-to-do, less formally educated Jews with a very, very rich culture, but who nonetheless were like a shanda, although they wouldn't have used that particular word, a shanda for those people in Vienna who were feeling like, you know, they just wanted those people to tone down and shape up and look more like the imperial capital and not remind everybody of Jews as a people of difference. So East Habsburg Waltz was dedicated to my Oma. Fortunately, she was still alive when I first wrote it, and she did get to hear it. And then Waltz, because it still was from Vienna. But that just happened to be the tune that wrote itself. It wasn't like I went out looking for a waltz, but something came to me in 3/4 time.
And there it is.
And this is actually the second recording that we have of it. We have it on our earlier CD also, Greetings from the Isle of Klesbos, and I love that version also where Rochelle Garnier is playing an accordion solo. But on this new CD, we have the marvelous, amazing Shoko Nagai. So Rochelle had a wonderful stretch with us, and then Shoko's been playing with us, you know, quite a long time, and that was another reason, along with our vocalist Melissa Fogarty, that we absolutely needed to have Isle of Klesbos in our current lineup represented. It had been far too long that we've been performing live with these wonderful women and not had a recording with them. So that's what Live from Brooklyn represents. And so East Habsburg Waltz in its incarnation with Shoko's unbelievable keyboard talent.
And just think, if not for one choice way back when, it could have been you on that track with a ukulele.
Yeah, and let me just name my other bandmates.
Please.
So people know that.
Yeah.
A co-founder of Isle of Klesbos with me is Pamela Fleming, our amazing trumpet and flugelhorn player. And speaking of the Indigo Girls, she used to do the Lilith Fair tours. And
yeah.
She'd be with Natalie Merchant's band, but soloing with the Indigo Girls, I think every single night of, 2 years of the tour. And then Deborah Kreisberg, who came into Isle of Klesbos just in our second, year of this wonderful, so far 18 years long, 1999. So she made it in just in time for the 20th century. And actually, she came to our very first performance because she was friends with our original bass player, Catherine Popper. So she has seen it from the very beginning. And as I said, both Pam and Deborah are amazing composers. Pam's contribution to the current album is this klezmer reggae track called Mellow Mana.
Yes.
Pam had also been touring with Maxi Priest and Burning Spear and all these great reggae people for a long time. And Deborah does wonderful Latin jazz as well, and she wrote a tune called Noir-esque, which we all absolutely are in love with. Just her very original melodic and harmonic things that just come from her her compository pen or whatever it is. And she plays both clarinet and alto saxophone, so we're really blessed to have those women. Saskia Lane is on the bass, and she's beautiful with both the arco, playing with the bow, as well as all kinds of upright talent. And then we have Melissa Fogarty, who I already mentioned, who has been, everything from a child singer at the Metropolitan Opera to Baroque and early music and New York City Opera sort of go-to person for really, really difficult new music that people have to learn very quickly. And she's also a tremendous improvisationalist. She does scat solos on our swing tunes, and was tremendously helpful also at transcribing stuff where somebody has to have just such very fine talents of, auditory perception. So she's really the one that I enlisted to go after the fine points of the underscoring from that Gomer Pyle show, because a lot of the tune is actually behind dialogue, and Missy could just pick it out.
So great. And that is the Isle of Klesbos. I have to tell you, Eve, I'm so inspired by everything that you do. I will say there is a piece of me that just in reading your bio and then having this great opportunity to speak with you, I feel like I should be doing more. And so it's so great just to hear how you pursue these passions and you get this work out there. And my hope is that you and everyone else in the Isle of Klesbos, you are so most certainly inspiring everybody who hears your music to learn more, to certainly just be entertained, but also to be inspired to use their own voice in their own unique way. It's so great to feature everything that you're doing.
Thank you. Well, that's certainly gratifying to hear.
Oh, it's great. Everybody needs to stroll on over to klezbos.com. That's K-L-E-Z-B-O-S. Your music is certainly available on iTunes. It's available through your own website. There's a link there. I enjoy Live from Brooklyn just tremendously. And by the way, I don't want to move past, I even love the cover art. And I'm very critical of cover art. It's great cover art there, Eve.
Well, thank you. Yes, if we had another show, we could talk about the references to the fall of Icarus.
Such
but
great
yeah, there's
stuff.
There's a Brooklyn Bridge on there, but we sell it. Oh, sorry.
This is all to say we certainly want you back, Eve. I barely got into any of my questions. It's just so great to hear all the great things that you're doing. And on behalf of all of our listeners, please keep doing what you're doing, Eve.
Well, thanks. And everybody, happy Hanukkah. And if you know anyone who wants to come down and see us, we'll be playing in January at City Winery, which is a great New York venue that has a klezmer brunch. We'll be playing there in mid-January, both of their bands together on a double bill on January 17th. And, this very week that I think we're broadcasting, if you know people who want to come out and see J. Edgar Klezmer songs from my grandmother's FBI files, believe me, it's a rare treat for us to be able to present it with all six of the women, and that's going to be December 5th. So I so appreciate being on your show, and mazel tov to you.
Thank you.
What was this episode, 300 what?
332. I know, Eve, we just keep going. I don't know where it's going to end. I don't think ever. So we're just going to keep featuring great people. And that's the thing. Like, I really and truly said this to someone this morning that someone said, why are you still doing the show? And I said, because I get to talk to these people who are doing such unique things. 332 episodes later, did I think I was going to be talking about klezmer music? Absolutely not. It's because there are unique voices out there using their voices in their own specific way to get people involved, to build community. And you are doing that. And that's what keeps this show going, Eve. It's people like you. It's not me.
Well, you're doing it, though.
All right, I'm doing it.
Thank you. I feel honored.
Again, listeners, klezbos.com. Eve, a real pleasure.
Me too. I'm a chaya. Let's all learn that together.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, but certainly a little bit left, so we can discuss the latest LGBT news that's out there. John Bel Edwards is still a month away from being sworn in as Louisiana's next governor, but he's already signaling a change from the Bobby Jindal administration by announcing plans to issue a pro-LGBT executive order. One newspaper in New Orleans reports that sometime after his inauguration on January 11th, Edwards will sign an executive order to protect his state's gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender state employees and government contractors from getting fired, being discriminated against, and harassed. No timetable was announced by the governor-elect's transition team. Matthew Peterson of the LGBT advocacy group Equality Louisiana told the newspaper, quote, "People deserve not to be fired from their jobs because of who they are," end quote. It is currently legal to fire someone for being gay or in a same-sex relationship throughout most of Louisiana. The newspaper reports that New Orleans and Shreveport are the only cities that have enacted laws to prevent businesses from firing a person for being LGBT. The newspaper notes that the executive order would not protect non-government employees, nor would it necessarily apply to state government outside the governor's control, such as the judiciary. Still, this would be a huge step for Louisiana. So, a changing administration there in Louisiana. It's kind of a dramatic change from the Bobby Jindal administration. Bobby Jindal, who has since dropped out of the presidential race, but in his time as governor, he's still kind of the governor there. He's just not there often in Louisiana. He was a staunch defender, and not even just defender, but a proactive advocate of a religious freedom law, some sort of statute that protected businesses from being able to discriminate. But now we have John Bel Edwards about to be sworn in, and he is signaling a huge change for the life of our LGBT brothers and sisters in Louisiana, so we will certainly keep our eye on that. After her constituents rejected an ordinance that would have banned discrimination against several minority groups, including LGBT people, Houston Mayor Anise Parker told residents of Jacksonville, Florida, to not make the same mistake. Parker told the Duval County Democratic Party Gala on Monday this, quote, "We lost because fear, once it has taken root, can only grow, and a lie repeated and repeated and repeated sounds like the truth." Parker was referring to the anti-transgender campaign waged against the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, also called HERO, in which business leaders, ministers, and high-ranking politicians claimed the new law would allow men to dress up as women, infiltrate public bathrooms, and abuse women and girls. In reality, the law would have allowed transgender people to use the restroom of their choosing, not to mention ban discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations for over a dozen minority groups. The city council passed the ordinance in 2014, but voters repealed it there in Houston last month. Anise Parker went on to tell those county Democrats, quote, "The opponents didn't really care that it protected veterans and pregnant women. It was just about men in the bathrooms." Anise Parker encouraged equality supporters to counter the lies of opponents and for young voters to encourage the city council to act on expanded protections. But Jacksonville's non-discrimination ordinance is proving just as controversial as Houston's. Jacksonville's mayor has not taken an official stance, but instead called three community meetings to discuss it. The Anti-Gay Liberty Council, which had a hand in defeating HERO in Houston, is working to kill expanded protections in Jacksonville, Florida. It's working with a local attorney, Joey Vaughn, who told the media, quote, "There's no evidence of widespread discrimination against LGBT people in Northern Florida." So that is happening in Northern Florida, although I'm much gratified to see different municipalities working with each other. I think too often we get a little bit insulated, especially if you are in a place like Vermont, where all the protections are there for you. Great, that's amazing. But don't keep that in Vermont. You then have an obligation to work with other states who are really struggling. So this is kind of on the other end, where you had Anise Parker in Houston, a place where that HERO ordinance was soundly defeated. I mean, really, really soundly defeated. And she's getting out there and trying to help her colleagues in other municipalities who are dealing with the same fear-based tactics that unfortunately worked in Houston. And now they're trying them out in Jacksonville, Florida. So good for working together, because we have to. Otherwise, this is not going to happen. We will not achieve full equality. If you are looking for the perfect holiday gift, you can turn to the Human Rights Campaign. The LGBT rights group is selling a baseball cap that's a variation on the one Donald Trump often wears at his campaign rallies. The slogan printed on it is, quote, "Make America Gay Again." A play on Trump's Make America Great Again. It also bears HRC's equal sign logo, and on the back is printed with LGBTQ and equality. HRC is not the first to offer a twist on the Trump headwear. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, a Democrat, wore a cap bearing the words Make America Fair Again at an event focusing on income inequality, and the Democratic Party has sold caps emblazoned with America is Already Great. Trump hasn't had a lot to say on LGBT issues during his campaign, although he has said at least that being gay shouldn't be a reason for being fired from a job. He has a long record of opposition to marriage equality, calling himself a traditionalist, but unlike some Republican candidates, he hasn't talked much about this topic in the current race. Indeed, LGBT people have generally escaped the bombast he has directed at immigrants, Muslims, and other groups. So again, you can go over to hrc.org and you can get a Trump-type hat, but this one says Make America Gay Again. There's a new study out that indicates maybe why straight women are friends with gay men. Women and their gay best friends have long been a central theme of TV shows such as Will and Grace, and now this new study has found a scientific basis for the social phenomenon. Researchers at the University of Texas at Arlington affirmed that women trust dating advice from gay men more than from straight men because gay men have fewer ulterior motives. Women are also more likely to befriend gay men in a highly competitive dating environment, such as a university with more female students than male students. This is what the findings showed. This is a quote from Eric Russell, who is the paper's lead author, quote, "This provides novel experimental evidence that there is more to the gay male straight female friendship than just what we see on TV. Certain social psychological processes are indeed driving these relationships in real life." This study involved nearly 700 straight female students at a major public university in the southwestern U.S. As part of the study, they were asked to evaluate the trustworthiness of a straight woman, straight man, or gay man based on mock social media profiles. And Vivian Ta, one of the study's co-authors, said this, quote, "It's riskier to trust other straight women when mating competition is high. Unlike other women, gay men do not undermine women when they are seeking out mating partners. Gay men do not compete for the same men as straight women do." So there you go. We have some empirical, data-based evidence of why women might want their gay best friend. I love that story. I love when there's research to back up some familiar tropes that we see throughout society. Cool stuff. Hey, a huge congratulations to Holland Taylor. Holland Taylor, one of my favorite actresses out there. I used to be a huge fan of The Practice. My best friend Christine Deegan and I used to watch The Practice just religiously. We loved that show, and Holland Taylor was this amazing judge on The Practice, and she just came out of the closet. And she came out of the closet in yet again this great way that's very casual, where something came up and people said, wait, are you gay? Are you now out of the closet? And she said, I've always been out. I've never been in the closet. Very casual, very modern. It's not this big coming out of the closet, big bombshell cover of Time magazine, yep, I'm gay. It's just an individual saying, yeah, I'm gay. Why? Did you not know that? I've been dating women for my life. So congratulations there to Holland Taylor. We don't really do celebrity gossip, but apparently she's dating Sarah Paulson, who another celebrity who I also enjoy immensely. So congratulations to both of them. Again, we don't really deal with Hollywood gossip, but fun stuff there. Fun stuff there. And that, my friends, is really all the time we have left for this week's episode of This Show Is So Gay. Our huge, huge thanks to Eve Sicular, Isle of Klesbos. What an amazing name for a band. And then, of course, as you're hearing the music this episode, what an amazing band. So go check out their music. You can go to klesbos.com, KLEZBOS.com, and you can get their music on iTunes and anywhere else where fine music is sold. Very exciting show coming up for you next week, another new episode. But this concludes episode number 332. You guys, you know what to do. Get out there and use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? Fällt mir ein Ohr.